Well, good morning, everybody. My name is Jack, and I am an alcoholic. And I come to you all from Hagerstown, Maryland, where I am a member in good standing of the cleverly named Hagerstown Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our group is the third oldest group in the state of Maryland, and we just had our 65th birthday. And when our group was started, you had one town. You named the group after the town. And as you all know, a couple of resentments and a few coffee pots later, we got 18 groups and 50-some meetings, but that's how we grow in AA. I want to thank the committee for allowing Alan, in case you don't know, that's Alan right down here. He's the one that invited me. And I think it's real important that you know who's responsible for my being here this morning. Because if I say anything that offends you during the next 2.5 hours we're together, you take that up with Alan. Because he's the one who invited me. If I happen to say anything you approve of, well, by all means, see me after the meeting, because I could really use those attaboys. Richard said he'd heard me speak before, and he didn't listen to me then. He's been in the car with me for the last day and a half. He hadn't listened to a word I said. I tried to explain to him that once he was here for 10 years, it would become clearer to him. So that was his oblique reference to no double-digit sobriety. Don't give up your day job, Richard. My mom's 96 years old, and she was married to my alcoholic father for 30 years. It doesn't have a whole lot to do with my alcoholism, but I think it's important that you be aware of that, because when I went to see my mom on Thursday to tell her I was going to be away this weekend, she asked where I was going, and I told her, and she said, "Are you going to be talking to another one of them AA things?" I said, "Yes, ma'am, I am." She said, "Well, you make sure you tell those people that you are not an alcoholic." Like to start listening to my mom. It's about time. I mean, she being married to my alcoholic father for 30 years, she's got some information that's pretty valuable to make that assessment. And well, it's quite possible I've overreacted to this whole thing. And we'll see if we can develop any facts that would lead us to the conclusion as to whether or not I'm here under false colors or not. Good morning, Mrs. Bailey. Nice to see you this morning. Well, you stay alive, I'll keep sending them. Seems fair. Stamps are going to 32 cents for postcards. Just shows you how much I love you. I'm going to put my watch up here, not because I can see it or really pay any attention to it, but I just think it gives hope to the newcomer. So I started to drink when I was about 14 years of age. My sense is that once I got enough alcohol on board to feel the effect produced by alcohol, that alcohol did for me exactly what it did for you if you're alcoholic. It changed my entire relationship to my environment. It allowed me to do things while drinking which I could not do not drinking. And it was indeed the elixir of life. I knew immediately why my dad drank. It was unfortunate my dad couldn't control his drinking like I could, but I knew why he drank. I used to say that drinking didn't cause me any difficulties in the early years, but now as a result of good sponsorship, I am required to tell you that I spent 5 years in high school. I like to think it was because I was seeking a solid academic foundation before I launched out into the world, but it really turned out it was the drinking. But after I graduated high school, I went to the local community college, and one summer my good friend Bill and I had decided we wanted to take a road trip. We were going to drive from Hagerstown, Maryland to California. And we got 12 cases of beer, put them in the back of my car. We each packed an overnight bag, and we had everything you need for a trip to California. Quit my job, had a pocket full of money from that. The night before we were to leave, Bill's dad said he couldn't go. And, well, I was crushed, but I'm not driving to California by myself. And Bill was a stand-up guy. He gave me his half interest in the 12 cases of beer. And as you people know, I mean, the state of Maryland, the easternmost border of Maryland, is on the Atlantic Ocean, and we've got a resort community there called Ocean City. And so I drove down to Ocean City, and I spent a month living in Ocean City as a bum. I didn't have a job. Lived in the basement of hotels where I knew people who were bellhops and desk clerks, and I ate leftover restaurant food at restaurants where people were working as waiters and waitresses. I didn't have to pay anything for room and board, and I had those 12 cases of beer and that pocket full of money to buy more beer when that ran out. And I had a great month in Ocean City that summer. I really enjoyed it. In fact, I enjoyed it so much that I determined that I wanted to work in Ocean City the next year. However, it became apparent to me that if you drank like I drank and acted like I acted when drinking, over the course of a summer, there was a very good chance of getting arrested. It didn't make any difference if you were a lifeguard or a beach boy or a waiter or a waitress, a bartender. It just didn't matter. If you drank like I drank and acted like I acted when drinking, over the course of a summer, there was a good chance of getting arrested, except there was one group of folks who drank like I drank, acted like I acted when drinking, and they were not getting arrested. And these were the members of the Ocean City Police Department. So I became a police officer. Now, they gave me a boardwalk beat, and within a matter of days, it became readily apparent that I possess a talent, an instinct, if you would, that came in mighty handy, and that is I can spot an underage drinker from about 100 yards. And I'd pick out my target of opportunity, and I would approach them, and I would establish that indeed they were underage, and I would ask them what they had in the cooler. And they would tell me. Some Coca-Cola, a little Tupperware thing with tuna fish in it, half a loaf of bread. Would you mind opening the cooler? They lift the lid, nice even row of Coca-Cola cans and the crushed ice. But I would reach way down into the bottom of that cooler, and invariably, I'd come up with a Budweiser. And if you're that underage drinker, your life as you have known it has just ended because you're going to jail. Well, I know you think you're going to college, but you're not. You're going to jail. And that college that's admitted you, once they find out you've been in the Ocean City jail, they're not going to have anything to do with you. Now, maybe you think you're going into the military. Well, let me tell you something. The United States military's already got enough problem people like you. They don't need anybody else. When they find out you've been in the Ocean City Jail, your military career is over. As a matter of fact, I'm going to call your mom and dad back in Baltimore at 3 o'clock this morning. And I'm going to tell them, you're locked up in the Ocean City Jail, and they got to come get you out. What was that? You want to offer a compromise, an alternative solution. What did you have in mind? Confiscate the beer. Well, that's certainly worthy of consideration, but you do understand that if I confiscate the beer, I'm taking the cooler. And if I take the cooler, I am taking the Tupperware, the tuna fish, and the half a loaf of bread. You're okay with that? Okay. You have to promise me that you are never, ever going to do anything like this again in Ocean City. You promise? Okay, you're free to go. It is not easy to walk a boardwalk beat while dragging a cooler full of beer around behind you. So I had to work out a deal with my lieutenant and sergeant, and they'd come and they would collect, in their squad car, they'd come and collect the coolers as I accumulated them. And then we would meet at the end of the shift, and if I'd gotten any wine or any whiskey, I'd give it to the lieutenant and the sergeant, and I'd take the cooler and the beer and the tuna fish. And I had a great summer that summer. I drank every day. I didn't buy anything to drink the entire summer, and I didn't get arrested. So I went back for a second summer. Now, the second summer, they gave me a squad car. Yeah, squad car. Lights and sirens, and one of those big old Ford Crown Victorias. You ever look at the trunk of one of them things? I mean, you can get three bodies or five coolers in the trunk of a Crown Vic. And I didn't really need my lieutenant and sergeant, but they maintained a keen interest in my activities, and at the end of every shift, I'd give them the whiskey and the wine, and I'd take the coolers and the beer, and if you came down to Ocean City and you were a friend of mine or a friend of a friend of mine or maybe just an acquaintance of a friend of mine, if you needed a cooler, I'm your guy. I got coolers stacked up to the ceiling of my back porch, and you're free to come and pick anyone you want. I got a no-return policy. And I just try not to get arrested because I won't be able to help you. And I had a great summer that summer, drank every day, didn't buy anything to drink the entire summer, and I didn't get arrested. So I went back for a third summer. Now, I'm going to tell you an event that occurred that third summer that really changed the course of my entire life. Keep in mind, now, I'm finished with community college. I'm at the University of Maryland College Park. I'm a college kid, not really sure, you know, where I'm headed for, what I'm going to do. Big question mark hanging over whether or not I'll graduate or not. Part of that problem was that my blood alcohol content and my grade point average were running neck and neck, and that'll really slow you down. So stop this guy at 3 o'clock or in the morning, 3 a.m. on the beach highway, and he was obviously drunk, and I got him out of the car and I rode him up, and he says to me, he says, "You don't know who I am, do you, officer?" "No, I don't." He said, "Well, I am the state's attorney for Worcester County, the county you're standing in right now." "Well, I told you I'm a college kid. I've never heard of a state's attorney. I don't know what a state's attorney does. I've never seen one before." So I said, "Well, good for you. Sign the ticket." And he signed the ticket, and there was a guy there appeared to be, sober, so I let him drive. They went on their way. I pulled into the Ocean City Police Department, 8 o'clock in the morning. There was the chief of police. He came to me and he said, "Come up to my office and bring that uniform citation book with you." Now, these were the first words that the chief had spoken to me all summer. I'm about to get recognition for a job well done. Long overdue recognition, I might add. And so I went up to the chief's office, and much to my surprise, as I walked into his office, right inside the door, seated on the couch, is the guy I gave the ticket to at 3 o'clock in the morning. Chief says, "Give me that ticket book." I give him the ticket book. He opens it up to the ticket. He hands it to the guy on the couch. The guy on the couch takes out a pen, and on the face of that ticket, he writes, "Case dismissed," and signs his name. It was at that moment that I decided I want to be a lawyer. And I most definitely want to be one of them state's attorneys, because if you drank and drove like I drank and drove, the ability to dismiss traffic charges with a stroke of a pen was going to come in mighty handy. So I went to law school. Law school slowed my drinking down a little bit, but I graduated, and I met my wife at the University of Maryland, and we got married, and when I got finished with law school, we moved back to my hometown, Hagerstown, and I started practicing law, and about 6 or 8 weeks into that, I became aware that the local state's attorney's office was seeking an assistant state's attorney, so I went right over. "Here I am. Answer to your prayers. When would you like me to start?" Now, what I'm about to tell you is what I thought I heard them say. Apparently, this has happened in your life. It turns out that I've heard a lot of things said that were never said, and I've seen things happen that have never happened. But this is what I thought I heard them say. "What? Are you some kind of an idiot? You just got out of law school. You've never been in a courtroom. You've never tried a case. You've never impaneled a jury. You've never made an opening statement or a closing argument. You've never examined or cross-examined a witness. We don't have any time to train you. Get out of the office." That's what I heard them say. Now, as a result of good sponsorship, I can tell you this morning that I do believe that they really said, "The position has been filled." But I heard what I heard, and I know it won't surprise many of you to find out that I am a very sensitive person. And I don't suffer well. I left that office that day. My feelings were hurt. And I was upset. And I now know I left that office with a resentment. And as many of you know, an alcoholic with a resentment can do quite a bit. So in Maryland, just like here in New York, we elect our prosecutors. And so I found a lawyer who wanted to be state's attorney. I ran his campaign for state's attorney. He got elected state's attorney. He made me deputy state's attorney. Now, when you get to be deputy state's attorney, they give you a badge. And with that badge, they give you a badge case. And that badge case has a clear glassine window. You put your driver's license behind it. And when they pull you over and they ask for your license and registration, you show them your badge case. They don't really care about that driver's license. They are very interested in the badge. "Oh, the badge officer, deputy state's attorney, Washington County." "No, sir. No, sir. I am not upset that you stopped me. No, sir. You're just doing your job." Yep. It's true that I have had a couple of, well, okay, maybe 6 or 7. But I don't have that far to go. No, it's just maybe a mile. Uh-huh, yeah. "Oh, sure, I can stay on my side of the road, yeah." Well, I really want you to know how much I appreciate the professional courtesy which you're extending to me. Yes, sir, officer, you have a nice night also. Yes, sir. Well, some of you probably got a little insight into why I've never been arrested. But it will get better. My boss, the state's attorney, he was going to get appointed circuit court judge. And if he got appointed circuit court judge, I'm going to get appointed state's attorney. But I think this probably happens in New York sometimes. Your local state senator sticks his nose in where it doesn't belong, screws everything up, and some other guy got appointed circuit court judge. And I was very disappointed for my friend. But I was some kind of upset that I didn't get appointed state's attorney. And I may not be much, but I'm all I think about. And so one night while having some adult beverages with some like-minded individuals, it was determined that somebody had to do something about that state senator. We had to show him he just couldn't mess around like that. Somebody needed to run against him in the next election. We needed to get a volunteer. So I ran for the state senate. I didn't know the state senator was going to run off with the secretary from the Appropriations Committee, abandon his wife and children, and move to Florida. But he did, and I got elected state senator. Now, in Maryland, when you get elected to the state senate, they give you a license plate. And that license plate says, State Senator. And when they come up behind you on the interstate, and they got those overheads going on, and they get close enough they can see that license plate, they turn those overheads off. And they come up alongside of you. They turn that interior dome light on, and they toot. Beep, beep. Hi, Senator. Hi, Trooper. Hold it down, Senator. Okay, Trooper. And that way, you don't have members of Maryland State Police tied up alongside of the highway with members of the Maryland General Assembly when they could be out arresting real crooks. That guy who got appointed circuit court judge, he didn't like the job. So he quit. I went over to see the governor. I said, Governor, I'd like you to appoint my friend, the state's attorney. I'd like you to appoint him circuit court judge. He said, Senator, I'm sorry, but I can't do that. Too much adverse publicity associated with that last judicial appointment in Hagerstown. I will not appoint your man circuit court judge. However, if you'd like to be circuit court judge, I'll appoint you. See, you thought you had to be smart to be So I became a circuit court judge. Scary, isn't it, Gene? Yeah. Did I mention that I like to drink? I do. I love to drink. I love everything about drinking. I was a barroom drinker. In Maryland, the position of circuit court judge is an elected position. Where better to meet the public than in a barroom? I love neon lights. I love the way the lights in the bar reflect into the back bar mirror, and then they reflect forward through the various shaped bottles. You know, the tall bottles, the thin bottles, the square bottles, the round bottles, the pinch bottles. You know, I love the way it It reflects through the liquids contained in the bottles, the greens, the yellows, the tans, the darks, the clears. I love sawdust on the floor. I love peanut shells. I love the smell of stale beer and urine. I love it all. I love the ambiance of drinking. I love the glassware of drinking. I mean, right now, I mean, just a couple of weeks ago, we just put away the really long, thin Tom Collins glasses, put them away, their warm weather glass drinks, you know. And I like the little squat old-fashioned glasses. I love them. I love the fluted stemware of the gin martini. I mean, where can you get olives like that, buddy? I have to admit that at one time I had a love affair with a gin martini, and I had a really, really bad gin experience, and even to this day, it's hard for me to go into a pine forest. So, my beverage of choice was Jack Daniel's Black Label and crushed ice with a twist of lemon. But if you came up to me and you shoved a brown paper bag at me and said, "Here, Judge, take a pull on this," I wouldn't ask you what's in that bag, because you wouldn't offer it to me if it wasn't good. And, you know, on this kind of a weekend when the NFL is playing and you have people over to the house and you have some popcorn and some beer and stuff, and then the game's over and everybody's left, and you got to clean up, and there's cans everywhere, and you're picking up cans. Ooh, this one's got a little something in it. Oh, man, what was that? Cigarette butt. You're right, yeah. You got that right. Oh, I knew there were cigarette butt drinkers in here when I came in this morning. Oh, yeah. You don't have to raise your hands. I see you. Yes, sir. A room full of my people. Yeah. Yes, indeed. Yeah, well, April the 7th of 1982, a local attorney and I had determined that we were going to go out and get drunk. Told my wife we were going to dinner, but we were going to get drunk. This was not going to be one of those occasions when I negligently allowed myself to be overserved. The object was to get drunk. Knee-walking, snot-flying drunk. And we did. And had I known that this was going to be my last drink of beverage alcohol, I can assure you that I would have ordered something else. Because as you're about to hear, what I have to tell you, I'm required to tell you this, it's embarrassing. And there is a significant amount of shame associated with it. And you can rest assured, if I had any idea that I was going to be invited to this Jones Beach breakfast with Mrs. Bailey and all of her friends, I would have ordered something else. My last drink of beverage alcohol was Tia Maria. You think that's funny? There's nothing funny about that. How do you think I feel? Now, I can see from the expression on the faces of many of you that you don't have any idea what Tia Maria is. Well, I'm telling you, you don't need to know. Don't be going out on another run for Tia Maria. I don't want you coming down to Hagerstown complaining to me. All right? I mean, you're in Alcoholics Anonymous. Why don't you just stay here? I mean, what the heck? P. People died last night. Never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. Other people died who have been here and went back out. In here, we get to live. In here, we have a design for living that really works for the alcoholic. I'm alcoholic. I've never experienced any pain whatsoever in Alcoholics Anonymous as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. The pain that I have experienced here has been a direct result of my resistance to Alcoholics Anonymous, my insistence on doing it my way. So if you're here, come along with us. Do what we do. I mean, what the hell? 50, 60 years from now, if you've ever reacted, you can go back. My wife's an elementary school teacher. I think the elementary school children in Maryland are probably like the elementary school children here in New York. They're just germ-encrusted. They got germs all over them. And a teacher goes in the classroom, and those germs jump off the student onto the teacher. And then the teacher comes home, and the germs jump off the teacher onto the spouse of the teacher. And after my Tia Maria night, I got up the next morning, and I had flu. Flu. Those pesky little kids had done it to me one more time. But we go to work. Not missing work. Miss work. Somebody might say my drinking was interfering with my work. Next day was Good Friday, so the courthouse was closed, and I didn't have to go to work. Developed that upset stomach thing that frequently accompanies flu. And Saturday, I still got flu, but now I got lower tract distress that frequently accompanies flu. And if you got lower tract distress combined with that upset stomach thing, I mean, that will hone your decision-making down to a fine edge. And I didn't know whether to kneel or sit or sit or kneel. And on at least one occasion that weekend, I made the wrong decision. And if my wife was here, you could talk to her about that. But Easter Sunday, I felt a little better, but I'm still doing that kneeling and sitting thing. And by Monday, I am really dehydrated, so they put me in the hospital to hydrate me. And that night, my abdomen became distended, and they performed an emergency laparotomy on me and opened up my abdomen. It was full of gangrene, peritonitis. And then my liver was out of whack, and my pancreas was digesting itself. And then my kidneys quit. And then my respiratory system failed. And things were just not looking good for the home team. And I was in intensive care in Hagerstown for 3 weeks. They got me off the respirator, but everything else kept going south. And so eventually they sent me to Johns Hopkins Hospital. And at Johns Hopkins, I thought that was a good thing because I knew people going to Johns Hopkins, they'd lived. I knew people going to the Hagerstown Hospital, they died. So I was kind of encouraged. Got down to Johns Hopkins. They did everything but hang me by my thumbs. And my belly button birthday is May the 14th. Well, May the 13th, the doctors came in, and I said, "Whoa, guys, hey, I can't take it anymore. I need a day of rest. Tomorrow's my birthday, please." They said, "Judge, that's why we're here. I mean, we've presented your case to the internal medicine department. We cannot get a majority vote on what's wrong with you. So we're not going to do anything tomorrow. We're going to give you a day of rest." So I turned 40 in the Johns Hopkins Hospital. 2 weeks later, May 28th, I was discharged from Johns Hopkins Hospital. My kidney function returned. My liver enzymes got back in line. My pancreas stopped digesting itself. And when you're in a hospital like that for 7 weeks, they like to talk to you before you go home about the do's and don'ts so that you don't come back anytime soon. But if you got an undiagnosed illness, they don't know what to tell you. And I think it's better to survive an undiagnosed illness than to die of a known cause. I mean, I thought that then. I still think that this morning. And I was almost out of that doctor's office when one of those doctors said to me, "Judge, can we ask you a question? Do you drink?" What kind of question is that? I'm a lawyer. Well, I used to be a lawyer. I mean, I'm a judge. But when I was a lawyer, I had to drink with clients. I had to drink with other lawyers. I had to drink with judges. Now that I'm a judge, I got to drink with lawyers. I got to drink with other judges. Of course I drink. It's a matter of professional obligation. How much do you drink? Not much. Why do you ask? Well, we think, Judge, that you should maybe not drink for a while because nothing destroys the kidneys like alcohol, and we don't know what would happen. Your kidneys are back functioning, but they're very delicate, and we don't know what would happen. And then there's the matter of your liver. We don't know if you have any permanent liver damage or not. And then there's the pancreas. Nothing destroys the pancreas like alcohol. And your pancreas isn't digesting itself anymore, but we don't know what would happen. Well, how long do you want me not to drink? A year. Oh, yeah. Ooh, that's right. Ooh. Ooh. Well, I haven't had a drink since April the 7th. This is May 28th. I think I can do that. They said, "No, Judge, you don't understand. This is Memorial Day weekend. We want you to not drink for 1 year from June the 1st. Now, I think there are people in this audience this morning who have already discerned the injustice that those doctors were trying to foist upon me, because I'm getting no credit for my 7 weeks of continuous sobriety. I want you to know an argument broke out between those two learned physicians and this knuckleheaded judge as to whether or not I would drink next April the 7th or would I wait until June the 1st. And they said if I thought on April the 7th that the pain, suffering, and misery I just endured had anything at all to do with drinking, then I would not drink till June the 1st. And with that, I walked out of the Johns Hopkins Hospital into the most insane period of my life. Not drinking. Not changing. Not drinking. Not changing. Sounds very similar to don't drink and go to meetings. I sure hope you find folks here in New York do not tell newcomers don't drink and go to meetings. Because we kill people when we tell them that. Because they believe us. Our book says, you take alcohol away from the alcoholic gets restless, irritable, and discontented. And that is a gross understatement in my case. I was more pissed off in the spring-loaded position. And the only choice that an alcoholic has when they're not drinking and not changing is pick up a drink, slow suicide, or pick up a gun, fast suicide. Our book says that, and our experience confirms that. Absent an essential psychic change or a vital spiritual experience, there is no hope for the alcoholic. I thought my problem was drinking. Turns out my problem's not drinking. Big Book says clearly my problem has got nothing to do with drinking. Drinking's a symptom. If drinking was my problem, I quit drinking, live happily ever after. I quit drinking and the problem started showing up. The insanity became intense. The book says the problem for the alcoholic centers in the mind. Well, that's thinking. That's what goes on in my mind. Thinking. Simply how I think is my problem. S-H-I-T. Simply how I think. I am not good at thinking. I am disqualified from independent thinking. I need supervision. I need guidance. I need direction. I need to tell you that my alcoholic father, on July 3rd, 1968, passing a church in Hagerstown, and on the message board, the pastor had put the following. This was the message on July the 3rd. Do not buy a fifth on the 3rd for the 4th. My dad went to AA that night, and he never drank again. And when he died with 15 years of continuous sobriety in this marvelous program. And alcohol took everything from my dad. Alcohol took that 30-year marriage to my mom. It took the respect of his children, that's me and my young sister. It took a business he had built from scratch for 25 years. It took our house. It took all of the material things and all of the priceless things. It took his integrity. It took his self-esteem. It took everything from my dad. And then my dad came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and Alcoholics Anonymous gave me dad back, my dad, the stuff that you can't buy. They gave him back the priceless stuff, gave him back his integrity, gave him back his self-esteem, allowed my father to become the person that God had created him to be. And I carry his 15-year chip with my chip in hopes that I can make a small payment on the huge debt that I owe Alcoholics Anonymous for my father's life. Alcoholics Anonymous gave my dad a life and allowed him to live and become the person that God had created him to be. And I am eternally grateful. There are two guys in Hagerstown who knew my dad, Ken and Bob. And Ken and Bob are active members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they're watching me die of untreated alcoholism, not drinking, not changing. Crazy, just crazy. And they came to me, and Bob said, Jack, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we have a book. We call it the Big Book. And we were wondering if maybe you'd like to read it and find out about your dad's illness. Clever guy, that, Bob. If he had said anything remotely like, we think you should read it to find out what's wrong with you, there's nothing wrong with me. You see, with every passing day of every passing month of every passing week of every passing year that I'm not drinking, that is proof positive that I am not alcoholic, because everybody in this room knows that alcoholics drink, and therefore if I'm not drinking, ergo not alcoholic. I mean, I might be a little on edge, okay, I could be a little prickly, quick to anger maybe, but you know, you and I get along a lot better if you just mind your own business and just do what I tell you to do, you know, because everything with me is fine, okay? I'm fine, just leave me the heck alone, all right? Fine. Well, I was interested in learning about my dad's illness, so I read that book. No surprise to me, my dad's in there. He's a real alcoholic, as defined by the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. He has every reason to be in there. However, I was surprised to find that in that book they have written about events in my life that I experienced, and they wrote about them before I was born. How could they know things about my life and written them down before I'd even experienced them? I went back to Ken and Bob, and I told them that there was a chance, a possibility, a remote possibility, but a possibility nonetheless, that I may have contracted a rather mild case of alcoholism. We caught it just in time. Well, that's all Ken and Bob needed. Every Friday, they came to my chambers, that is my judge's office, and they brought their big books, and they brought a brown bag lunch, and we would sit at my conference table, and we would eat our lunch, we would pray the Serenity Prayer, we would read from the big book, and they would explain to me the importance of what we had read. And I would explain to them as Jack sees it. I pointed out to Ken and Bob, I think it's important that I point it out to you, that while it is true that I spent 5 years in high school, I think it's important that you know I graduated from community college 2 years with an associate's degree. 2 years after that, I graduated from the University of Maryland College Park with a bachelor's degree in 2 years. I went over to the University of Maryland School of Law, and after 3 years of study, they gave me a Juris Doctorate degree with honors, I might add. And Ken said, Jack, we have degrees on rectal thermometers, and you know what we do with them. They said, at my office. I had never heard that before. I've heard it a lot in AA since I've been here. But you see, Ken and Bob were willing to risk hurting my feelings because they knew my feelings had been hurt before and I'd get over it. They were willing to risk angering me because they knew I'd been angry before and I'd get over it. But they're watching me die of untreated alcoholism. And if something doesn't change and doesn't change soon, I'm not going to survive. You see, they knew something that I didn't know. Is that my wife? She thinks I'm at a spiritual retreat. I'm easily distracted, and I'm sorry, Glenn, but my name is Jack, and I'm an alcoholic. I come to you from Hagerstown, Maryland, where Ken and Bob knew something I didn't know. And I didn't know what it was that they knew that I didn't know. And they knew, if I had known that they knew something I didn't know, the mere fact that I knew that they knew something I didn't know, not knowing what it was that they knew that I didn't know, just knowing that they knew something that I didn't know, not knowing what it was that they knew that I didn't know, would make me angry. But they were persistent and consistent because they knew that if they were to continue to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to me, that there may very well come a point in time when I would actually know what it was that they knew that I didn't know. And at that point, I wouldn't be angry knowing that they knew something I didn't know, because then I would know what it was that they knew that I didn't know. Because in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know when you know that you know, and not a moment before. Now, if you followed that, you're in the right place. And if you found that to be the least bit confusing, well, you're still in the right place. Just means you don't know, that's all. It was December 22nd, 1989. It was a Friday before Christmas. I should say here parenthetically that when I was drinking, my wife and I were separated on 3 separate occasions, and there were women involved. She didn't laugh. When I was not drinking, my wife and I were separated on 3 separate occasions, and there were women involved. Don't leave, girls. It gets better. I think that's pretty clear evidence that drinking had nothing to do with any of those 6 separations. And alcoholism had everything to do with all six separations, and we had no idea. So on this particular occasion, December 22nd, I'm separated from my wife. I got a girlfriend, I got a backup girlfriend, and I got a girlfriend for special occasions. My girlfriends object to my wife. My wife objects to my girlfriends. And I told Ken and Bob, my sponsors, that I was managing this very well. That's just another one of the 100 forms of self-delusion that we talk about. So the courthouse was closed, and Bob and Ken and I had lunch. We went our separate ways, and I went back to my apartment. And propped against my apartment door was one of those Hickory Farms packages that you see at Christmas. Somebody had sent the judge a cheese log or a sausage, and this is nice, and I think I'll take it in and maybe a little snack. And I'm taking the answers off my answering machine, and I'm trying to figure out how this box is sealed. And I get my car keys out, and I see where it's taped shut, and I'm listening to the... I got plans for that night. I got plans for Christmas Eve. I got plans for Christmas Day. I got plans for New Year's. I got plans for well into the following year. I cut the tape on this box, and I'm listening to the messages on the answering machine, and I lift the lid to the box. Boom! And I got blown back against the wall. Now, a federal appellate judge in Birmingham, Alabama, had been killed about 5 days before that by a package bomb sent to his home. About 2 days before, a lawyer in Savannah, Georgia, had been killed by a package bomb sent to his office. I could smell the gunpowder. I knew I'd opened a bomb. There was a fire. I tried to put it out. I couldn't. I went out in the hallway and pulled a fire alarm. A neighbor came and said he had a fire extinguisher. I went back into the apartment to a telephone to call 911, and when I pushed the buttons on the phone, I became aware that part of my right hand had been blown away. And they said, police, fire, or rescue, and I said, I'd like to have one of each. And I hung up the phone from that call, and it felt like somebody was pulling my trousers off my hips. And I looked down at the floor, and I'm standing in a puddle of blood, and it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger as I'm looking at it. And I know I'm in serious trouble. And my neighbor comes and asks if there's anything he can do. And I ask him to get me a towel, and he did. And I opened my trousers. I did not have the courage to attempt to visualize the wound. I just put the towel where I thought I'd been hurt. And I put my back against the wall, and I slid down onto the floor. And it was pretty clear to me that I was dying. And I was alone. And I was scared. And I was powerless. And I didn't know if I was going to die on that floor, never see my wife and our three children again. And I didn't know what to do. I did not know what to do. And it occurred to me that on every Friday that Ken and Bob and I met, that we began our time together with the Serenity Prayer. So I asked God to grant me the serenity to accept this thing which I couldn't change, the courage to change what I could, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I prayed that prayer, 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 and I can't tell you whether it was the fourth, fifth, or sixth time through that prayer, but what I can tell you is that prayer was answered, and God came. God came. And I was overcome by a sense of peace and well-being, the likes of which I had never experienced before, nor have I experienced it since. And I knew if I died on that floor that afternoon, never to see my wife and our three children again, it would be okay. It would be okay. And the police, fire, and rescue guys burst through the door of my apartment, and both of my eardrums had been blown out, and they were trying to communicate with me, and I was trying to communicate with them. And as soon as I stopped that prayer, a tremendous wave of fear swept upon me, and I told these guys, I said, you all do what you have to do. And I'm going back to what I was doing. And as soon as I went back to the Serenity Prayer, that sense of peace and well-being came back. And they cut all my clothes off of me, with the exception of my red and green Christmas socks. They wrapped me in a blanket, strapped me on a backboard, put me on a gurney, and carried me down three flights of steps, and stuck me in an ambulance, and our local TV station was there and got a picture of my red and green Christmas socks sticking out the end of that ambulance. And those socks went around the world on CNN, and I went to the hospital for surgery. And they couldn't find my wife, and they couldn't find my girlfriend, but they found my sponsor, Ken, and they let him come back to where I was being prepared for surgery. And he held my hand, and he prayed for me, and we prayed together. And they took me up to surgery, and I don't know how to tell you. Shrapnel knows how to stop passing through flesh. I can only tell you what they told me, which is they removed a rather significant piece of shrapnel, not resting against, but in close proximity to my femoral artery. And had my femoral artery been nicked, you would definitely have a different speaker here this morning. And they took me up to a recovery room, and when I came to, seated at the foot of my bed was my sponsor, Bob. Let me say here, it's good to have a sponsor. And it's really good to have a sponsor. I mean, sponsors see things differently. They have a different take on things. I mean, if you're new here today and you don't have a sponsor, there are literally hundreds of people in this room who are qualified to be your sponsor. Do yourself a favor. Don't leave here without a sponsor. We're not asking you to get married. Just asking you to get a sponsor. You know, maybe you've been here a while. Maybe you got some sobriety under your belt. Maybe you and your sponsor have drifted apart. Maybe your sponsor has moved away or passed away. Maybe you're doing that ism of alcoholism, the old I sponsor myself thing. If you're sponsoring yourself, I don't mean to be rude, and I certainly don't mean to be unkind, but you got an idiot for a sponsor. Get a sponsor. Bob's at the foot of my bed, and he's smiling. I said, "Bob, I notice you're smiling." I said, "What are you smiling at?" He said, "Oh, Jack," he said, "I just think it must be wonderful to know that you can't be harmed." I said, "Harm, Bob?" I said, "Somebody just tried to kill me." He said, "Oh, Jack," he said, "I understand that." He said, "I understand that box you opened contained four pipe bombs." He says, "One pipe bomb is more than adequate to kill a human being. Two pipe bombs is redundant. Three pipe bombs, that's around the bend. Four pipe bombs, Jack, you have made somebody very angry." He said, "In point of fact, Jack, man has done his very best to kill you. And the only explanation of your survival is the grace of God." Good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't have come up with that in a million years. He said, "Jack, God has spared you for a purpose. God has work for you." I said, "Really, Bob? What kind of work does God have for me?" He's always said, "I wouldn't be so presumptive, Jack, as to hazard a guess as to what God's will is for you in that regard. But," he said, "I do know this. I know that it's God's will for you to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That means you're going to have to pray that third step prayer with me or with Ken. You're going to have to do that fourth step inventory. Do that fifth step with Ken or with me. You're going to have to make that sixth step decision. Pray that seventh step prayer. Make that eighth step list. Begin making those ninth step amends so you can live in 10, 11, and 12 and fit yourself to be of maximum service to God and to your fellow man." Good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't have come up with that either. I got out of the hospital on Christmas Day. Best Christmas I ever had up until that point. The following Christmas, my wife and I reconciled, and we have been together ever since. Last August, we celebrated 45 years of marriage. If she were here, you'd probably want to give her a chip for that. She's been married a whole 45 years. As you've heard, I had time off for bad behavior. So, so the adventure began. The adventure began. And I started to take action on the steps. I know now that when Ken and Bob and I were meeting in my chambers and I was not drinking and not changing, that I had what I like to call cake mix sobriety. Now this is a box of Duncan Hines Red Velvet Cake Mix. And on the back of this box, Mr. Duncan Hines has a 3-step program for the production of a red velvet cake. Now, I'm the kind of guy, I mean, we could take this box and give it to Richard, and he could read step one to us, and we could discuss it. And then, you know, we could give it to Mrs. Bailey, and she could read step two, and we could discuss that. And then we could give it to Bruce, and he could read step three. And I'm the kind of guy, having read the back of this box, I'm looking for my cake. You see, I'm meeting in my chambers every Friday with Ken and Bob, and we're reading the big book, and I'm looking for recovery. I'm looking for cake. I haven't opened the box. I haven't broken an egg, and I'm looking for cake. I'm looking for recovery, but I've done nothing but read about the steps. I haven't broken a sweat. And so I began the journey. I used to hear early on that insanity, a definition of insanity, was repeating the same behavior over and over and expecting a different result, and that kind of resonated with me. But then I heard a much more succinct definition of insanity, and that is to join a 12-step program and don't do the 12 steps. That's crazy. I mean, that is true insanity. I come here for help and tell you how I want to receive it. That's crazy. You know, we had this big party in San Antonio last year. I hope many of you were there. If you weren't, please put it on your calendar now for Atlanta 2015. Do yourself a favor. It will be a life-changing experience for you. I promise you that. If you don't have a life-changing experience in Atlanta, then come see me. I would like to talk to you about that. But in San Antonio, they said if we had any suggestions as to how we could improve our program, that they would welcome those suggestions in New York. So I wrote to them. You know, we got a lot of literature. One of the things, we got this pamphlet, is AA for You. Now, we've already established that the problem for the alcoholic centers in the mind. It's not about the drinking, it's about the thinking. And we've already established that simply how I think is my problem, S-H-I-T. But here's my suggestion for the improvement of this pamphlet. Let's see if any of this resonates with you. Have you ever decided to stop thinking for a week or so and only lasted for a couple of days? Do you wish people would mind their own business about your thinking and stop telling you what to do? Do you envy people who can think without getting into trouble? Have you ever had problems connected with your thinking during the past year? Has your thinking caused trouble at home? Do you tell yourself that you can stop thinking anytime you want to, even though you keep thinking when you don't mean to? Have you missed days of work or school because of your thinking? Have you ever felt that your life would be better if you did not think? Well, apparently that resonates with some of you. Just drop them a line up there at New York. They'll be happy to hear from you. You know, or you could just take the train into town, pay a personal visit, you know. Tell them Jack sent you. You know, in our big book, it talks about having a solution not only for the drink problem, that we have a solution for what they call the nine bedevilments, daily living. You know, I'm sure this probably doesn't apply to anybody in here, but it said, you know, we were having trouble with personal relationships. Did I mention my girlfriend, my backup girlfriend, my wife? Yeah. Couldn't control our emotional natures, prey to misery, prey to depression, couldn't make a living. Well, I made a lot of money doing what I was doing. And Bob had to point out to me that I was spending more money than I was making, and therefore I was having trouble making a living. Because anytime you spend more money than you're making, you are having trouble. Feeling of uselessness, full of fear. You know, and you know, maybe next week or the week after next at a meeting, just slip up behind somebody and whisper into their ear, "They know," and walk away. I mean, that used to give me the whim-whams when I said it, because, you know, I was doing stuff I shouldn't be doing. Now, what I've learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous, the goal is to live a transparent life. And so if somebody comes up behind me and says they know, well, what is there to know? There's nothing to know. I mean, what you see is what you get. I'm not doing anything I shouldn't be doing. If I was, I need to stop doing it so I can live a transparent life. So that I can, in fact, be happy, joyous, and free in Alcoholics Anonymous. And make no mistake about it, if you're here this morning and you're not happy, joyous, and free, you need to talk to your sponsor. Because the book guarantees each and every one of us happy, joyous, and free. So I need to find out what it is I'm doing that I shouldn't be doing. Or I need to find out what I ought to be doing that I'm not doing. But AA guarantees happy, joyous, and free. Guarantees it. Turns out that happy, joyous, and free was what I was looking for in the bottle all along. That sense of ease and comfort, the ability to wear life as a loose garment. Alcoholics Anonymous gives that to the alcoholic. You know, before 1934, there was no hope for us. And then Ebby went to see Bill. And Bill went to see Dr. Bob. And make no mistake about it, Bill did not call Ebby. And Dr. Bob did not call Bill. So let's not sit smugly in our meetings and say to ourselves, oh, they know where to get it if they want it. They'll be back. They know where to find it. No, they won't be back. They say, well, if it ever gets that bad, I'll come back. But when it gets that bad, we never come back. And we don't pick up the phone to call anybody. So those of us who have been given this gift of sobriety, we have this unique opportunity to change the lives of other human beings by a phone call. So pick up the phone. There's got to be somebody that you know that you haven't seen. Just call them up and say, how you doing? Because if they're sitting home alone thinking, they're without adult supervision. Now, it says in our book that great events will come to pass for you and countless others. And of our three children, our second child, our oldest son, Robert, was the most damaged by my drinking and my not drinking and not changing. And Robert got married, and he had a little girl, and my wife and I were privileged to be there when the child was born. And in February of 2 years ago, they had a little boy, and again, my wife and I were privileged to be there when the child was born. And it took me back to where the mom and the new baby were, and I said to my son and daughter-in-law, what have you named your son? And our daughter-in-law said, you didn't tell him. And he said, well, I thought we'd tell him together. And they named that little boy Jack. Power of God goes deep. Broken relationships are restored. Broken hearts are mended. I couldn't have brought that about if I'd have tried with all of my might. I couldn't have made that happen. And God has healed that relationship between my son and myself to the extent that he would be willing to name his son Jack. Now, that's a great event that's come to pass for me and countless others in my experience. We got this pamphlet in Alcoholics Anonymous called A Member's Eye View. I assume all of you have a copy of it. I assume all of you give it to your sponsees. I assume that all of your home groups have it and that you have many copies of it and that you have read it thoroughly. I think it's the finest piece of AA literature that we have outside of the big book. That's my opinion. If you have read this pamphlet, then you have an opinion. It is not necessary for you to come up here and share your opinion with me. If you have not read this pamphlet, let me suggest to you that you would be well served to get a copy of it and to read it so at least you could have an opinion, because right now you got no opinion. But here is what it says at the end of this pamphlet. This morning, in many of the churches here, will be read that portion of the Gospel of Matthew, which recounts the time when John the Baptist was languishing in the prison of Herod, and hearing of the works of his cousin Jesus, he sent two of his disciples to say to him, "Art thou he who is to come, or shall we look for another?" And Christ did as he so often did. He did not answer them directly, but wanted John to decide for himself. And so he said to the disciples, "Go and report to John what you have heard and what you have seen. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, the poor have the gospel preached to them." Back in my childhood catechism days, I was taught that the poor in this instance did not mean only the poor in a material sense, but meant the poor in spirit, those who burn with an inner hunger and an inner thirst, and that the word gospel meant quite literally the good news. A number of years ago, two men, Ken and Bob, maneuvered me singularly and together into AA. If they were here and they said, "Tell us, Jack, what did you find?" I would say to them what I would say to you now. "I can only tell you what I have heard and what I have seen. It seems the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise. And over again, in the middle of the longest day or the darkest night, the poor in spirit have the good news told to them. God grant that it may always be so. My name is Jack. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April the 7th, 1982. As our friend Ed was so fond of saying, I love each and every one of you, and there's nothing you can do about it. Thanks for letting me share.